I'm going to talk about sovereign transition rate with dynamical fermions. Well, it's a kind of sovereign transition rate because it's in 1+1 dimension, and it's kind of dynamical fermions because these are bosonite fermions, something you can only do in 1+1 dimensions. But as I will try to argue, it is still an interesting question, and there's been a number of works addressing this question, how the dynamical fermions, how the fermions affect the sovereign rate. Right. In a way, my talk is similar to Jan's talk in the morning. So basically, I will present problems. I will not present the solutions. but let me just outline what I'm going to talk about. So I will present the model, which is the Abedin-Higgs model coupled to the fermions. Then I will try to briefly outline what I would call state of the art with respect to including dynamical fermions in calculation of the sovereign rate. Then I will discuss the static properties of this model when it includes dynamical fermions. And we'll see basically that even though you do some kind of bosonization trick, you reproduce very nicely what you expect of a gauge theory coupled to fermion in some ways. And finally, the sovereign transition rate and some inconclusive discussion at the end, because as you will see in a little while, the results came out quite surprising. So my talk will be much shorter than Jan's talk, simply because we ran into problems much sooner.
his hour talk took two and a half.
No, mine will be a lot shorter. I can promise you that. So, the model where you can relatively easily include fermions is the Abelian-Higgs model, and it is interesting in a way because it has properties similar to that of the standard electroweak model as far as baryon number violation or fermion number violation is concerned. It has a similar vacuum structure. That is, it has degenerate vacua labeled by the winding number, and transitions between those vacua, dynamical transitions between those vacua, are accompanied, according to the anomaly equation, by the violation of the fermion number. Now, what do you expect would happen if you couple this model to the fermions? Then the picture will change in the following way. If before, the Chern-Simons number, if you looked along the Chern-Simons number and asked what is the potential of the theory, then all the vacua would be degenerate. Now coupling to the fermions would change that, because now going to a non-zero Chern-Simons number corresponds to going to a non-zero fermion number. Now fermions have masses or otherwise have energy. That costs you energy, so you leave the degeneracy as you go away. The way you leave the degeneracy, of course, depends on the dispersion relation for your fermion. So indeed, you would not, once you couple to the fermions, you do no longer observe diffusion, infinite diffusion in that direction, but instead your system would fluctuate back and forth in the vicinity of the zero fermion number. That's what you expect. This is a schematic representation. then, of course, it's just exactly as you have in the standard model. You have Clapeyron transitions at finite temperature, and that's what I will try to discuss in a minute. So what do we know about the effect of dynamical fermions? I don't know if it's a fair representation of what is known. It is simply not an exhaustive list of works, but I mean, it's representative of what people usually do, I think. So basically, and this applies both to the Abina-Higgs model or to the standard model. So typically what people would do, they would in some fashion integrate out the fermions, which can be done perturbatively, or it can be done in some other approximation. For instance, here in the Abina-Higgs model, people would use a large enough approximation and obtain an effective theory for the remaining fields, for the Bose fields. Then in that effective theory, you can determine the Clapeyron rate using your favorite method. Or you can simplify your goal and simply determine the Clapeyron energy and see how it changes. That is what was done in a paper some time ago by Gould and Rothstein. They did it in a large F approximation, and they concluded that in the Abelian-Higgs model, having enough fermions increases Clapeyron energy and suppresses the rate. Then I understand there will be a talk later in this meeting by Kasper. You'll talk about this. So I guess I will not have much to say about this, but you have a lot more to say. Well, I understand that this is more like a dynamical calculation. He really include the fermions dynamically, so it does not really belong to this category. Okay. I should add here, while I'm talking about the Abelian-Higgs model, that without the fermions, we know quite a lot about the Clapeyron rate in the Abelian-Higgs model. We know the rate in the wide range of temperatures, namely at temperatures where you can make the Clapeyron approximation. And in that range of temperatures, we know that the Clapeyron approximation is reliable. This has been tested numerically. And the Clapeyron formula, the one-loop formula, which gives you the rate, is good in this case. We also know the rate in this model for the high temperatures. We know how exactly it depends. It depends on the temperature as a power law. So our knowledge is quite extensive here. So we can exactly determine what is the effect of the fermions. That's the advantage of the Abelian-Higgs model. In the standard model, of course, at this point, our knowledge is not nearly as exhaustive as we just heard this morning. But as far as inclusion of fermions goes, there is a little bit of controversy here. There was a paper by Dyakonov and collaborators saying that if you include one loop contribution from the fermions, then exactly like Gould and Rothstein claimed from the Abelian-Higgs model, that would substantially suppress the Clapeyron rate. But then a year later, Guy Moore came with a different calculation which showed that the Clapeyron energy does not change all that much. And, right, I should point out here that what these two works refer to, if my understanding is correct, is basically that you calculate here the Clapeyron energy, and from there you estimate the effect of the fermions on the rate, but you actually do not correct your bosonic determinant prefactor for the new terms you obtain in the Clapeyron energy which follow from integrating all the fermions. And as we will see in a while, these other corrections may be
different calculations.
These are two different calculations of the same thing, basically.
Okay. What I said is that the thermodynamic influence of the fermions on the Clapeyron is well represented by their contributions to the normalization of the coefficients of the boson part of the period.
Mm-hmm. And
period.
And what is it?
They said that it wasn't, but they didn't have a well-controlled normalization point. So.
This is all the good stuff.
Well, I mean, in the Abelian Higgs model, you cannot, it's one plus one dimension, so you cannot really talk about different phases, but you can qualitatively talk about high temperatures and low temperatures, and high temperatures are temperatures far below in the Svalbard energy, and that's where you can test the prediction of the Svalbard theory, the formula that includes the Boltzmann factor.
Maybe fermion here means
I can hear you.
Heavy fermion here means just a big
U-power. Big U-power coupling, right. I have not specified yet how is this compared to the temperature. Right. So this is the situation. And now the objective we had in mind is to test the procedure along these lines in a controlled environment, in this laboratory, where everything is under control, and at least we do not have fermions. So what can you do? Well, here is the model. First of all, that's formulated in the conventional language. So this is the Abelian Higgs model. So the field is the Abelian field. F mu nu, it's a bit of an exaggeration. It's actually F01. You don't have anything else. So it's basically the electric field is squared. You have the chiral coupling to the fermions. You have the usual covariant derivative term. This is a scalar field, simply a complex field in 1 plus 1 dimension. You have, the usual potential term. And then you have the Yukawa coupling. For the fermions. And now you can bosonize. This was following the recipe found many years ago by Kolman and by Mandelstam. And the recipe says that for the you can express the fermion, various fermion bilinears, if you introduce a scalar field. And this is the scalar field, sigma. So in the language of this new field that you introduce, you basically obtain a new Lagrangian, an equivalent Lagrangian, with the covariant derivative squared for the sigma field, for the Bose field, and a new term for the Yukawa coupling. It is interesting that in this model, the equation of motion for the scalar field becomes what is in the original thermionic language, the Psi language, is the anomaly equation. So that's point number one.
Is it obvious that this expression is gauge invariant? Or rather, how does phi?
How does sigma transform?
Sigma transform.
Right. Sigma basically transforms like an angle. So in other words, you add a derivative of something to A, then you add that something to sigma. That's the way it transforms. All right, so now you have two currents. You have the baryon current. This is the baryon current. You have then the chiral current. And then you can check that if you look at the equations of motion of the sigma field, then it exactly reproduces the anomaly. This is one of the nice features. Note also that in order to correctly reproduce our fermionic Lagrangian, we need to explicitly introduce as a coupling the Planck constant. So here the Planck constant appears explicitly in the coupling constant of the gauge field. This is necessary if you want to reproduce correctly the spectrum of your theory. So having this Lagrangian, you can then equivalently write the Hamiltonian. And basically now it's a time to make an approximation because we still cannot study this in a full quantum theory, so the approximation we do is the classical approximation for all the fields. Now, before we introduced the fermions, it was easy to do the classical approximation because nothing in the Lagrangian and in the Hamiltonian, excluding the fermions, or better look here, did not depend on the Planck constant explicitly. So you could go to the classical theory and then you could argue, well, my Planck constant is very small. I can think of it as being a small number, so the classical approximation is good. By making my Planck constant small, I can make the energy of an elementary excitation small compared to the tensor. I can always do that. I can always think of a very small Planck constant. Here you need to be a little more careful because you introduce the Planck constant explicitly, and so you need to be careful to ensure that with this special value of the Planck constant that you have introduced, the h bar omega, which is the energy of any elementary, typical elementary excitation, be much smaller than the temperature, which is the condition you're being in the classical regime. So simply by choosing the right relation between h bar and the temperature, and knowing the typical frequencies in your system, which you can easily determine, you can assure that you are in the classical regime.
The classical wire, does it depend on the regularization? The capital Y
can be expressed. No, it does not depend on the regularization, but it is related to the Yukawa coupling. I'll show you in a minute how exactly it's related to the Yukawa coupling.
If you have those exponents sigma, there's some power divergences in there.
Here are the exponents.
Yeah.
No, there are no divergences.
No, but I mean, so the temporary construction.
Right.
Probably that. Y probably depends on the regularization or on the renormalization compared to little y. I'm just wondering.
Right, there is something going into, but in the classical theory, I think you can write it at least naively the way. You can at least write a naive expression which is related to two. I'll show you.
Here is capital Y is small Y?
No, they're different. No, they're different. But they're related to each other.
In this polarization.
Yeah. And if you don't, then you have to have some power divergence.
But I think it's just that, nothing more than normal.
Right. Well, to admit the whole truth, there is a little bit more. there are four Fermi terms which in principle should be included if you want to bosonize absolutely correctly. But even this bosonization as it stands has some nice qualitative features, as I will show in a moment.
So basically you want to take this to be the model.
Right. Let's take this to be the model. Let's see that it has nice qualitative features, which you expect from the theory that includes the fermions. And let's see what it gives.
But it seems, I mean, can you understand intuitively how did the H bar appear? This was because it is an exponent?
Well, I'll come to this in a minute. But the idea is that what was the fermionic excitation in the original fermionic theory, in this bosonized language, becomes a topological excitation, classical topological excitation. Now you want to match the masses of the two. The mass of the former is proportional to h bar. It's just h bar times some frequency. The mass of the latter is not. It's a classical theory. But to match the two, you need to introduce h bar in the bosonic formulation. All right, so let's see the relevant static properties. let me just point out one more thing before I proceed. And that is that you can now fix the gauge and discuss the dynamics in a special gauge. Namely, since the way the sigma field enters is through a derivative, you can remove this field from consideration by choosing a gauge. So you do a gauge transformation with a gauge parameter equal to sigma, and that's how you remove it. And that's how you now obtain this Hamiltonian, which with the sigma field not present. And now you can count your degrees of freedom. So actually, in this formulation, you have 2 degrees of freedom corresponding to the scalar field. It's a complex field, plus 1 more degree of freedom corresponding to the gauge field. So indeed, you have 1 more degree of freedom than otherwise without the fermions. And so this is in the sigma equal to zero gauge, so to speak. Right. It is explicit in here. Alpha is the conjugate momentum of the phase of the scalar field. And this expression exactly comes from satisfying the Gauss constraint. So having said that, we can briefly discuss the static properties. So first of all, and this is explicit in the sigma equal to zero gauge, but also in another gauge because sigma only enters as a derivative, the baryon number is simply the integral. Let's think about periodic boundary condition. Is simply the integral of the A field. And in this sense, the baryon number really coincides with the Chern-Simons number in the Abelian-Higgs model. This is exactly the expression for the Chern-Simons number of the Abelian-Higgs model. Now, we can see that the static properties are more or less exactly what you would expect from the Abelian-Higgs theory, including the fermions. This becomes obvious if you make an approximation in which you essentially keep the magnitude of the scalar field fixed. So you make an assumption of strong self-coupling of the Higgs field. So the magnitude is equal everywhere to the vacuum expectation value. And in this case, the potential term for the phase. So the remaining variables are now the phase of the Higgs field and A, the gauge potential. The potential term becomes like this. You can first minimize it with respect to the gauge field and express the gauge field in terms of the derivative of the phase of the scalar field, the two are related. And now you can resolve also for A. And now you find the relation corresponding to the value of the baryon number for the various vacua. So consider now vacua corresponding to different winding numbers of the scalar field. And see how the baryon number is related to the winding number. Then what you discover is that the baryon number is proportional to the winding number. But if without the fermion, that is, let's say when h bar were equal to zero, this would be an exact equality. Now introduce some quantum corrections. So the baryon number is now not equal to the winding number. It is of course equal to Chern-Simons number, but not to the winding number. That is, if you consider a vacuum.
I want to just that formula come about the top formula. It doesn't look gauge invariant, for instance.
It is gauge invariant. It's exactly the same way. Nothing in this respect, nothing has changed when you introduce the fermions. That's exactly the formula.
This isn't a fixed gauge.
No. This is completely general now.
What is A squared?
Which formula are you now talking about? This one or the potential? Oh yeah, this isn't a specific gauge.
But the top formula, it's also only
a no, the top one is gauge invariant.
It can make a large gauge transformation and change the baryon number by one.
That's right.
But then it's not gauge invariant.
It's not gauge invariant or large gauge transformation. It's exactly like Chern-Simons number. Ah, yeah, you're talking a variant number. No, no, no. No, here you're absolutely right. This is gauge invariant. This is gauge invariant, but let me see.
You specified your large gauge.
No. But now what happens is that you have lost your invariance in the large gauge transformation. Look at the potential of the theory.
If you go one sheet back, you have the
right
translation formula. What's the curve? Is that gauge?
Right.
Current?
Let's go one. It is. Right. As you can see, the R gauge invariant.
So it's only valid in that gauge, probably. The top formula on the next sheet is only valid in this gauge you've chosen, sigma equals zero gauge.
Right, but the spheroidic boundary conditions, it doesn't matter. Suppose you impose spheroidic boundary conditions. For the density, it matters.
It has to be very good. This is manifestly gauge invariant, but the other formula wasn't. That's why I got...
Yeah, why not impose spheroidic boundary conditions on the field?
Yeah, but sigma is an angle, so it may change by 2 pi if you go around.
It's a one-way number as well.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, well, in the sense that the only thing that enters is the derivatives. So in that sense, it's a winding number. But variant number must be gauge invariant. Variant number is a gauge invariant quantity.
Yeah, but the variant number in terms of Chern-Simons number holds only, that explicit formula, I think, holds only in the sigma equals zero gauge.
Right, but let's go back to the original language, to the original fermionic language.
Yeah.
Suppose that you do a large gauge transformation.
It's obviously gauge invariant from that formula.
But the state corresponding to another Chern-Simons number has a different energy, doesn't it?
Well,
now that you have no longer the degeneracy.
It's not gauge invariant, so in principle.
No, but what we had before is doing transformation on a large gauge transformation will get a new value of Chern-Simons number.
Yes.
But then if you look at the energy, it would remain invariant.
Yeah.
Now, this is not the case.
Well, it just, the spectrum stays the same, but the way the states are filled, that differs if you do it dynamically.
Yeah, but there's no fermions.
No, but you refer to the fermion. If you then do a large gauge transformation,
right,
then the Chern-Simons number changes. But I was to say the spectrum, that stays the same. So it's absolutely gauge invariant. The only thing what changes if you don't do a large gauge transformation, if you do a dynamical.
But I'm thinking about a specific state. Take a state with zero fermions, do a large gauge transformation. What do you get?
It gets you very, the energy stays the same, so the spectrum stays the same.
Yeah, the energy stays the same.
Then how do you get to a state with one more fermion?
It's a massless fermion, right? So why does it cost you energy?
Think about a finite box. Then it does cost you energy.
It's only the change in just that gets you energy, so in that sense it's no problem. But I think that other formula, if I understand it now from your slides, holds in the sigma equals zero gauge.
Well, it certainly does. Okay, unless you impose spheroidic boundary conditions, then in that case it holds. In any case,
no, I think
on sigma.
The winding number has to be
unless. Well, it probably doesn't really matter. The gauge invariant thing is this object.
Now I'm puzzled by a different question with that slide, which was you have two things which I thought were going to be integers, but now one is related to the other by a radius of correction. So which one is the integer?
No, no. It just says, no, wait a minute. It just says, no, this one is surely the integer.
This one is the
right. This one is the integer.
So I'm creating.
This is always the integer. This is the winding number.
Fractional variant.
Right. The state with the with the minimal, the local minima do no longer correspond to integer variant number.
It must be surprising because the potential that the wiggles are on top of is going up like this. The minimum isn't at the bottom of where the wiggle would have been.
This is because your potential is tilted now.
That's a finite volume. I don't see the volume.
That depends on whether or not you have the mass.
Yeah, but I don't see the mass or the volume. But you have zero mass fermions. If I take infinite volume limit of continuum theory, why is there a shift?
Why there a shift?
Because you have the density of fermions, which is not there, which is V.
This is the vacuum with a given number of firm, with a given winding number. This is a vacuum with a given winding number. This is not a vacuum with a given fermion number.
Right, and then you have a certain number of variables, but you can have any fractional number that sits somewhere in the state.
That's right. It does not correspond to an integer. Fermion.
V is the average. It's like a quantum mechanical average. So it doesn't have to be an integer.
You can think about it as an expectation value. Exactly. It's not right. It's not a state of it's not a good quantum state of a Baryon number. Now, you can make a calculation. How does the energy of a state with a given winding number, but which is a local minimum, how does that energy can be how is this energy expressed through the Baryon number? And so what you find is that the energy in the massless case, when y equals 0, this is the massless case, what you find is that the energy of a state is proportional to the b squared. This is exactly what you would expect if you had a finite box with finite chain in this case in one dimension with fermions. For a sufficiently large number of fermions, this is what you would get. The energy would be proportional to the number of those fermions squared. This is exactly the Pauli exclusion principle. So you produce this very nice. Now we're coming to the massive case. In the massive case, you can still make this assumption, namely that the magnitude of the scalar field is kept fixed, and then you discover that in this case, what remains of your model is equivalent to Stein-Gordon model, and then basically, to determine how the phase of the scalar field varies, you have to solve the Stein-Gordon equation. And so from here it's explicit that fermions correspond to Stein-Gordon kinks. If your fermion is heavy enough, then in order to determine the energy, you simply count the number of kinks multiplied by the mass of those, of each one of them. And that gives you the relation. And then to match the fermion mass to the mass of the Stein-Gordon kink, you find that the mass of the Stein-Gordon kink in this case is the square root of y capital Y versus V times H bar. And then to match the fermion mass and the mass of the Stein-Gordon kink, you find the relation between this capital Y and the small y, the Yukawa coupling.
That's funny. That's proportional to small y squared.
That's right. They have different dimensions. But that's also obvious from...
One of the why gets dimensionful because of regularization, like normal order. You said you have a log in the exponent, and you get the power of the cutoff, which you have to make dimensional. Dimensionless because of that's your normalization point, how you normalize.
Which one are you talking about?
I was going back to the first slide.
Okay.
But this looks weird.
That's what you get from matching. Well, it is well known that the fermion becomes a sign Gordon kink.
Yeah.
That was how it was done originally by Coleman.
Yeah.
All right. You can ask how do you match the mass of the sign Gordon kink and the mass of the real fermion excitation. And the matching is perfect if you do it like this. And then from here it's also explicit that y depends on the Planck constant, the capital Y. Okay.
This is known.
That's why I said that that there are four fermi interactions missing here. My point was here just to show that you have here a model which has qualitative features very similar to what you expect from including fermions in the Abelian-Higgs model. The spectrum is very similar. It does exactly what you would expect. Now, for this Sphaleron, I don't know, we don't know how to make any kind of analytic estimate for this Sphaleron, for this Sphaleron energy. We don't know how to find this energy, but so we did it numerically. Now, this Sphaleron is an unstable solution of the theory, so you cannot determine its energy by simply minimization because it is not a local minimum. But you can find its energy by doing the following. You can form a new potential as the sum of the squares of the first derivatives of your original potential. And now, to any classical solution, you would have correspondingly a minimum of this, minimum equal to zero of this potential. And now minimizing this potential also for non-stable, you can find also the unstable solution and then determine their original energies. This was a method invented by some years ago by Van Baal and Margarita Garcia Perez. Uh-huh. Oh. Okay. I'll correct it for the next talk. So, and then with a good accuracy, you find in this numerical minimization that the Sphaleron energy as a function of y, well, it has a constant term, it obviously has to, because the Sphaleron energy is finite in the Abelian-Higgs model, it's a fixed number, which in these units that we use here is of the order 0.9942 to be exact. It's this number. This is the exact number known in the Abelian-Higgs model without the fermions. Then there is a square of y correction, which is in a way similar to what you have for the fermion mass, because remember also the fermion mass is proportional to the square root of y, so you expect pretty much the same from the Sphaleron, which sits right in between, let's say between the vacuum and the first the state with single fermion, plus some higher order corrections, and this fit was done for some specific small value of h bar 0.05. So
why is zero? You still have the fermions, and why is a the same as in the
In the infinite volume limit, you do get the solution is exactly the same. And the reason that happens is the following. Let's go back to this H here. Okay, so now you can consider this Hamiltonian. You can consider its potential part. That's the only thing you need to determine the Celeron energy. Now y is equal to zero. Okay, now you have the term which goes like a square. This term comes from the Cavourian derivative of the sigma field. And that's the only difference you have in the potential between your original Abelian-Higgs model and your Abelian-Higgs model with the fermions. But now, remember what is the gauge configuration corresponding to the Sphaleron. The gauge configuration corresponding to the Sphaleron the Sphaleron has a Chern-Simons number 1/2, and that Chern-Simons number is evenly spread over the whole volume of the system. So basically the formula is like A is proportional to and Chern-Simons number with the coefficient that can be derived from there, but it doesn't matter, over the volume of the system. That's how it goes. Now, if the volume goes to infinity, this term goes away. So in the massless case, there is no contribution. However, in the massive case, the situation changes. The way the gauge field winds is now different. It actually winds over, or it actually acquires the Chern-Simons number over a finite length. So you cannot really use this estimate when you have a mass. Right. It is interesting also to somehow represent graphically what happens here. When you include the mass, what happens is the following. You have originally, let's say, y equal to zero. You have your Maxingen hat potential, which looks like this. Now with some finite y, what happens is finite y, your Maxingen hat gets tilted. It can also be seen from here. Because you see that actually what happens is that this term here, the Yukawa term, is simply proportional to the real part of phi of the gauge field, of the scalar field. So what happens to your Maxingen hat potential is that it gets tilted like this. And then, at very large y, what will happen, if the tilt is too big, then the Maxingen hat will disappear, and that would mean that you will have no winding solution any longer. The Sphaleron disappears, the winding solutions disappear. That is when your fermions are too heavy. Okay, so finally this is what we get for the Sphaleron. This is the Sphaleron energy as a function of the fermion mass, or that's a function of the Yukawa coupling. And then you can go to a range of temperatures where these corrections to the Sphaleron energy become important and should be clearly observable in the Sphaleron rate. Okay, so now we go and measure. The way we do it, just a little technical point, is the following. Well, the procedure is standard. You let your system evolve in real time, picking your initial conditions from the thermal ensemble. So this is pretty standard by now. You choose the temperature such that the inverse temperature times the Sphaleron energy is much greater than 1. By doing this, you ensure that you are in the Sphaleron regime, where you expect the Sphaleron approximation to be reliable. And, well, you pick some arbitrary set of parameters. In this case, we picked m Higgs to m w square equal to 0.2, which is not quite realistic, but in this model, then it is not realistic anyway. That's not the point. That's not an important point here. You pick a small value of h bar to ensure that you are in the classical regime. And then, basically, what we did was to look at the evolution of Chern-Simons number, plotted here. But in 1 plus 1 dimension, evolution of Chern-Simons number has a peculiar feature that it has huge fluctuations if you have a big system. And that is because in 1 plus 1 dimension, you have directions in which you can vary Chern-Simons number, and that does not cost you any energy. So, how can you avoid this? What can you do about it? I mean, it is difficult to say something because of these huge fluctuations. So the thing you do, you cool your system down, and in the cool configuration, you measure Chern-Simons number, which in this case, unlike in the case that Jan discussed this morning, in this case, this is absolutely trivial to do. You simply cool your system down, and you measure Chern-Simons number, which in 1 plus 1 dimension is a well-defined object. And then you just count the number of transitions, and you determine the number of transitions per unit time.
What does it say about the fluctuations become larger when the length becomes larger?
Right. This is right. The point is that in 1 plus 1 dimension, you have the directions, which I would call the non-topological directions, in which you can really vary Chern-Simons number without varying the energy too much. So that means that creating a huge Chern-Simons number does not cost you energy. And how huge can that Chern-Simons number be? That depends on the volume. We consider it very large systems, so the fluctuations were really huge.
What's the frequency of those oscillations? Do they look like they're very mono?
Like they look
to the eye like they have a well-defined frequency.
They are, yeah, they do. The frequency is basically determined by the typical these are essentially perturbative fluctuations.
It's the string of mass, and the sum of the spontaneously broken mass.
That's right. That's right. Which in that case is a small correction, the Schrödinger mass, this term proportional to a squared.
Okay, so it's a continuum thing, not a lattice thing.
No. Nothing here is actually a lattice artifact. It's in this case, it's, everything is much, much nicer than in 3 plus 1 dimensions.
In the model so, without fermions, you never had to
cool. No. The reason is not, we do not cool because there are fermions. We cool because the system is huge. The systems we considered here are much, much bigger than what we did before.
Oscillations,
yes. The frequency of the oscillations is determined by the mass of the of
the. How big is the volume in mass units?
In mass units. In frequency units, you mean? Right. We're talking about hundreds.
No, they do not.
I should point out that there is no diffusion here. Strictly speaking, there is no diffusion because the potential is no longer exactly degenerate. So in principle, what you needed to do is to measure simply the correlator of the baryon number. But rather than doing that and then determining the slope, the exponential slope of the correlator, the logarithmic slope of the correlator, we simply, it is much easier to measure the number of transitions.
I'm missing something. In the beginning, you showed this plot of the potential and providing number, right?
And
right. Big peaks between the minimum.
Right.
Now, does this say that the peaks actually are very low?
No, this is not the change. These changes in Chern-Simons number, that's the point. These changes in Chern-Simons number do not correspond to changing the winding number.
Okay.
These are non-topological fluctuations.
Okay.
They do not entail the changing of the winding number. So to summarize the result, so this is how you do it. And now to summarize the result very briefly, five lines, six lines, the results are the following. First, you look at the massless case, and in the massless case, what you find that the presence of dynamical fermions has no impact on the rate. This is not terribly surprising, given that the Sauron energy has not changed. And so what else could change? What else could change is some kind of temperature dependence which comes through the prefactor in this Sauron formula. But that would happen only if the fermions introduced new zero modes which are specific to the Sauron configuration. And that doesn't happen, apparently. So really nothing has changed, and you will see in a minute that the rate actually is very close here to what you have without the fermions. Right. So this is the plot I was talking about. There isn't much to see in this plot. This plot compares the situation in which here you plot the rate and here you plot the inverse temperature. So you have diamonds corresponding to massless, to the model with massless fermions, and then losses, or whatever we call them, correspond to the situation with no fermions. You have a perfect agreement. And that's not really surprising. And both are in a good agreement with the Sauron approximation in this model. So this is not surprising. What is surprising, though, is the following. Now, you can choose a pick your favorite temperature, in this case, T equal to 113. And, okay, hundreds, that's what they said. The physical size was 250 in this case. And now you can vary the bosonic Yukawa coupling, which corresponds also to varying the real fermionic Yukawa coupling, and look what happens to the rate. So if you naively look at the Sauron energy, what should have happened to the rate was this. What did happen to the rate when you measure it was this, that is nothing. When we got first this result, we were very, very surprised. We rushed to look for bugs in the program. We didn't find any. Everything looks perfectly consistent. The program does an excellent job with thermalization. Everything else you look at looks perfectly consistent. The only surprising thing, and that's the puzzle now, is that the rate does not seem to depend on the Yukawa coupling.
It's not possible if you're dominated by that term. It implies you're in some high temperature case, right?
That's what...
semi-possible approximation.
Then you ask, well, maybe something is wrong with this particular temperature. Let's look at different values of the temperature. Let's go to a little bit lower temperatures. The same thing. And go here. The same thing. And it seems like in this particular case, what seems to be happening is that, well, this here reflects, I should stress, this here reflects simply the correction to the Boltzmann exponential. The correction to the Sauron energy. So in other words, what we compare is not the rate, but really what is plotted here is the correction to the Sauron energy, which is not the full story because there is also a prefactor.
From the fermions.
So apparently the situation here is that the prefactor in this particular case is equally important.
But why it is then so good at rate of zero?
So good where?
The prefactor would be added the temperature dependent.
The prefactor could in principle be temperature dependent.
But that you would think exponential.
But
but
it would not right.
But why is it like
this? Well,
why
that is not surprising. No, the fact is that is not surprising at all. This is not surprising at all, because the Celeron energy at y equal to zero does not change. They are massless. The Celeron energy does not change. It's the same as before.
But there's also determined. I mean,
how could the prefactor change in the presence of massless fermions? The only way it could change is that there would appear some extra zero modes that would be, because of the fermions, that would be specific to this Celeron configuration.
It's rather delicate change even, so that.
If that doesn't happen, then there is no way to change the prefactor. But this is a really surprising feature, and
how do you define the rate in a non-perturbed, guided by the I ray? How do you define it in principle?
How do you define it here?
You simply count
the number of transits. Otherwise,
yeah.
How could you otherwise define the rate? You could look at the correlator of the baryon number or of the Chern-Simons number and determine the decay constant of that correlator. That decay constant is related to the rate. In fact, it is proportional to the rate.
Actually, there might be an easy explanation to this. This is just fairly direct statistics. At zero temperature, you're either occupied or you aren't occupied. This big change to this Celeron energy has to do with somebody who is occupied getting hauled up to positive energies. But at high temperatures, everything is, on average, half-occupied in the infrared.
Well, the temperature. High. What do you call high temperature?
So what are they?
Well, I don't know. I'm just trying, okay? But
compared to the Celeron energy, the temperature is very low.
T is 1/14th in Celeron energy.
Okay.
Almost. In other words, the Celeron energy is a little less than one.
Compared to the energy
almost.
Of the lowest lying fermionic state.
Right.
If you're making the classical approximation, I assume somehow that the lowest lying fermionic states have an energy low compared to the temperature. Isn't that right?
I think so, yes.
In which case, they should, on average, be half occupied.
Which
case, their contributions to anything.
So
that would be an excuse for the most infrared part of the fermions not doing anything.
Well, what's your explanation for this?
No, but still, the Celeron energy has changed, and it has changed substantially. It's a very visible change. Nevertheless,
the vacuum.
The fermion mass in this case.
The vacuum.
Let's see. Let's have a quick estimate. So let's make a quick estimate for the fermion mass. So y. Let's see. Let me put up here.
Well, it makes a big difference in the 2+1.
But in the exponent.
So we have y equal to 0.01. H bar equal to 0.05 and V is equal to 1. V is equal to 1. So, right. The temperature is high compared to the fermion mass.
It's regulated at the scale set by the fermion mass, and the scalar subcoupling regulated by the scale set by 7 times.
I think what happens here, that is just the conjecture. What we thought is happening here is the following. Basically, the energy of the fermion is given by the tilt of the scalar potential. If the tilt of the scalar potential is not big compared to the Celeron mass, this is now just a conjecture. We cannot prove it. Then, basically, the exit, you have quasi-Goldstein boson. You have a quasi-Goldstein boson, which corresponds to going around the Mexican hand, around the rim of the Mexican hand. For that Now, what do you do when you calculate your Svelerin approximation? Your Svelerin approximation is essentially a Gaussian approximation. Now, that Gaussian approximation, I think, is not valid for this quasi-Goldstone boson. When you go around the rim of the Mexican hat, you cannot really approximate this excitation by simply its quadratic part. This is not correct. And I think maybe that is what goes wrong.
Unless the difference is made by so big that
you're... Unless you have a really, really huge...
No, but it's now that you're pointing to that picture...
This isn't, no.
The Svelerin energy, I guess, is measured with respect to the lowest state,
right,
or zero. But now you have transitions going both directions. So that other barrier from the other side is different.
Right. You can do a calculation and account for this effect.
And you have in that graph this solid line is accounting for that effect?
That solid line is not accounting for that effect, but if you do, not much will change. We have done, I can't reproduce it right now, but not much will change because of it is a real effect, like so, but it does not change.
You have a zero effect in the symmetry case.
Right.
But you don't this have is any more
it isn't, but it's not really a Goldstone boson anymore, but it may be close to being a Goldstone boson. So obviously for this excitation, you cannot really apply a Gaussian approximation. It seems.
Because the general effect gives square roots of the temperature for each. In the
prefactor. Right.
Which you...
Oh, you're talking about the Svelerin in the absence of the mass term. There is a zero mode, but the question is whether this zero mode... You see, there should be a zero mode associated specifically with the Svelerin, right? And not associated with the vacuum. You're talking about a zero mode associated with the really one of the vacuum configurations. Right.
Yeah, I was...
But this is not what happens here. So that's our puzzle. I am afraid there isn't much more I can say, except, well, there isn't much else to say, except that you have here a model which qualitatively reproduces the correct features of the Abelian-Higgs model with the fermions, which is nice. But then, you may or may not believe this, and then you can consider this model on its own right, and consider the Svelerin rate in that model, with this extra degree of freedom. And then, as I showed you, there is a puzzle. Maybe I should stop right here.